This is the Saturday Night Live birthday meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on May 27, 2000. Our speaker is John M. from Hollister, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL tape library. Please observe the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
And I'd like to thank Saturday Night Live and Mark and everyone giving me an opportunity to participate in an AA meeting. My sobriety date is December 28th, 1990. And I got sober at Saturday Night Live. So many of the people that helped me understand the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and how to apply the principles of AA into my life are in this room tonight. And I have to say, I feel like I'm being judged, you know. But and at the same time, I'm also here to let you know that I'm comfortable in my own skin tonight, and it's thanks to you, and it's thanks to AA. Before I get off on in my own little tangent about what it was like and what happened and what it's like today, I'd like to say that. You know, my dad had quadruple bypass surgery in December. And, you know, everybody said he was going to die, but, you know, his last name's McCracken and didn't, you know. And then, you know, and he's from Boston, you know. Roxbury, hard-nosed Irish Catholic, down and dirty, gut you Irishman, right? So, behind that, you know, he lives in Mexico and Phoenix and other places. And he was diagnosed with cancer in his kidney. And he's a sober member of AA. Let me tell you, he loves being sober. And he was laid up on the table 3 days ago and had a kidney taken out. And it was a bad kidney, so we're happy to see it go. But I went and visited him tonight. It was awesome. He calls me up on my cell phone because I got one. And he goes, do me a favor and pick up a toasted wheat turkey sandwich, light on the mayo, little mustard, and get it in here somehow, right? I said, I got your back, you know? So anyways, I get in there and I go see my dad. And I got to tell you, if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous and people like you, and the grace of God, that relationship would not be in place, not at all. And it was just an awesome meeting. You know, he looked up at me and he goes, you know, John, I'm proud of you, and I love you, and you're my son. You know, and these are things that you don't expect to ride off into the sunset with. You know, I'm 37 years old now, and I'll tell you, it was tough between me and my dad, and it wasn't his fault, it was mine. You know, I was a rotten kid. So, anyways, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you've lost everything, and you're on your last wheel, and you got a feeling that one's leaving you, stick around, because this is a wonderful, wonderful program that repairs just about anything, and I believe that. So with that in mind, I'd like to say I love you, Dad. I took my first drink for no apparent reason. You know, I was 9 years old, and I had three older brothers. They were my heroes, you know. And then I was stuck in between a younger sister and an older sister. And my brothers, let me tell you what, they're all macho guys and athletic, everything else, and they were my heroes. And they would never let me participate in anything they were doing because I was too young or I was too small or, you know, just never quite fit, you know. So one day, they're locked up in our little room that we were sharing in Cupertino, and they wouldn't let me in. So I go to my dad's toolbox, and I get a long screwdriver and I slide it through the little hole and I pop the lock and I bust it open and there they are. They're twisting joints and they're drinking Ole beers and Lynyrd Skynyrd's playing. And I look at them and I go, I'm telling. You know, and my... What do you do when you're nine, you know? So, for the first time in my life, my brother Kevin looks at me and says, come on in. You know, and I sit down next to my brother Kevin, and he cracks an Ole and he passes it to me. And I take a big swig, and I drink a little bit more, and he looks at me, and he goes, if you're telling, I'm telling, you know? And so that was the first time I ever saw a true sale go down. I'm in, you know? So... anyways, you know, I can't tell you that I was born an alcoholic, but I can tell you when I took that drink, for some reason I was never a sipper, you know. I drank to get drunk. I drank for the effect, and that's all I ever did. That's all I ever knew, you know. My sponsor was kind enough to teach me that there's three phases of drinking, of alcoholism, and it goes pretty much like this, where it's fun, and then it's fun and trouble, and then it's nothing but trouble. Right, and you know, the fun part probably lasted from the time I was about 9 until I was about 12 or 13. And then my dad cut a deal with a company here in the Silicon Valley to ship us over to Ireland. And we ended up in Ireland, Limerick, Ireland, when I was 13 years old. And I found out that you could walk into a pub and look at a guy and go, give me a bottle of whiskey and a six-pack for my dad. And the guy would go, okay. And bang, you know, there you go. So I started stealing money out of my dad's wallet or my mom's slender purse and roll into those little pubs, man, and say, you know, whiskey. And what a great place to learn how to drink, because everybody would look you dead in the eye and go, would you like another one, you know? Yes, I would. So... anyways, that's really where I learned how to drink, you know. I was tickled to be able to drink more than the average drinker. You know, you'd sit next to somebody and you'd watch them slam back two or three shots and maybe a beer, and then they'd look at you and say, would you like to play darts or something? And I was the guy that would pound like seven or eight shots, three pints, and have it spilling on me and say, rather play some pool, you know, and just load it, you know, never ever sipped anything. So we stayed in Ireland for 2.5-3 years, and I really, really graduated into that area of fun and trouble. I can remember my brother Greg was asked to leave the country of Ireland because he hit somebody too hard, you know, and we were having a going away party for my brother Greg, there's a guy named Derek Clancy, and he's older than me, and we're having a drinking contest, and my brother Greg is really proud of me because I'm winning, you know? And we get into our little Ford Avenger. My brother Greg is toasted, and I'm way, way past him, you know? And he goes, for God's sake, don't puke. I looked at him, I go, no problem, you know? And we get all the way home, and it's about 2:33 in the morning. My sister Lori, she's got one bathroom. My brother Greg's got another one. I'm knocking on the door. Let me in, you know, because I got to puke. And they won't let me in. So I sneak into my dad's closet. and I'm sitting in there, and the suits are kind of close. And you know, I'm starting to feel clammy. And I'm thinking, man, I need a boot or something. And... you know, just average drinker, right? And so I pick a suit, and I dress a suit, and I crawl out of there real quiet, and then I pass out. Well, you know, I wake up the next morning to a really pissed off dad, you know, you stupid son of a, you know. So anyways, and then, you know, in school, I would get busted all the time for little things, you know, get caught with whiskey in a coffee flask or those kinds of things. You know, and I don't think, you know, 13, 14-year-old kids usually get busted for stuff like that. They might get caught for, you know, stealing a radio or something, but, you know, whiskey, you know. So he does a good job over in Ireland, and we get back to Saratoga, and I begin attending Saratoga High School. And you want to know something hilarious? My best friend from Saratoga High School is in this room right now. And what's so funny is that we have partied down to the ground and back again for probably 15 years square together before we were introduced to AA. Anyways, when I was in Saratoga High School, all I did was smoke dope and drink whiskey and go to parties and go to the beach and then show up on Fridays for tests. Well, what that gets you is a 1.28 grade point average on graduation, you know? And the dean of students is looking at you saying, I'm so glad you're leaving, you know? So, anyways, you know, I'm not a stupid guy, right? You know, I ran the mainframe computer equipment for NASA, you know? I worked in the video teleconferencing systems before there was ever a video teleconferencing system known to man. I was building them prototype style with my best friend from high school. We weren't stupid. But see, what's so cool about alcoholism is it doesn't care. It doesn't care. If you're alcoholic, you're going to have a really, really shitty time with it, you know? And that's my story, you know. I never really, really could get out from under the problems that were tied to my drinking. As I was in high school, I started getting arrested and crashing cars and having problems. As I graduated, I stole a girl. And what that means is kidnapped. But, you know, when you're 18 and she's underage you guys are supposedly in love, you know, you're just running away. And that's what we did, but we did it loaded. They had an APB across California and Nevada for me, but, you know, they didn't think I had enough gas money for Colorado. So that's where we set up shop. We were out there. I was given plasma out of my right arm to put top ramen on the floor, you know. And I delivered pizza, and I was a kickboxer, and I was just anything but responsible. I smoked a lot of dope and drank a lot of whiskey, and really, really had no intention of creating a problem in this girl's life. But for some reason, when drinking is more important than the relationship suffers. And you can figure this out when you're sober, but it's really, really hard to figure out when you're loaded, you know? So, I basically ruined the first half of her life. Here's another friend from high school. I'm glad to see her, you know. But anyways, I won some money in a fight, and it gave me enough money to move us back. I bought a house in Los Gatos, or leased a house in Los Gatos. With my new wife and I, convinced a judge to marry us, and came back into Los Gatos Estates off of Pollard Road. And I remember tacking up my marriage certificate on the front door, so if her parents stopped by, they could know that I had the law on my side, you know. And you know. About 3 months, three, four months into staying there, we get a letter from her uncle. Now, her uncle is part of an association that I thoroughly admire, you know. The first side is H and the last side is A, you know. And I was like, wow, you know. And he was sending us a letter from jail. And he needed somebody that had a residency that was responsible, that could offer him a place to stay upon his release. Well, you know, feed my ego, you know. I'm 22, 23, and I look at my little wife, and I said, no problem. Got him covered, right? And God is funny, but he gets out, he moves in, and as a favor, he fronts me a kilo of cocaine. You know, I thought, what a guy, you know. But, you know, anybody in here, you know, I want you guys to know I'm not an alcoholic and anything. I'm just a down and dirty slime bag drunk. it turns out that I was in the age bracket where drugs was part of it, you know. But I'll tell you what, whiskey, and more whiskey, and then I'll do a line with you. And then, you know, whiskey, rum and coke, beer, and then let's smoke a joint, you know. But I'll tell you what, I'm alcoholic, and I'm not alcoholic and anything. You know, I smoked enough cocaine to curl your teeth. I'm telling you the truth. And it just turns out, common denominator is if I take a shot of whiskey, it's pretty much an unpredictable guy in front of you. The guy that fronted me that cocaine, we ran a lot of dope together throughout the production facilities here in the Silicon Valley, and I was making a ton of money. And one night he came to me and said, "Hey, I need you to do one more run, and oh, by the way, flip me a little bit on the backside, and I'll meet you at 2 o'clock in the morning over at the Potbelly Saloon." Right? I love that name. Right? Well, Randy didn't make it, and he was killed that night. And you know, it was that thing that my sponsor told me about, like fun and trouble, and then nothing but trouble. Well, from that point, my life in drinking was nothing but trouble. But the thing is that when you're loaded, it's really hard for you to assess that that's the turning point. That's where everything turns to a bucket of shit and remains that way until you find a spiritual solution to your malady, right? And that's, hadn't a clue. So anyways, that blew the marriage apart. It killed the families. Nobody could believe that this had happened. Certainly because I'm an alcoholic and I've had, you know, just enough time to think about what's happened, it was all my fault, right? Which gave me more reason to drink and more reason to become recluse and more reason to push people away from me and say, "See, you don't understand. This whole thing that I'm going through is way, way different than your deal," right? And so that allowed me to drink more. Well, I ran away from all my problems out here. I tried Los Angeles. Then from Los Angeles, I ended up in a tent in the El Dorado campsite just outside of South Lake Tahoe. And I was doing all the video arcade games and stuff because I was a video specialist for Harrah's, you know. And I lived in a tent for almost 3 months. And then blasted out of that tent and went back to L.A. And I thought, you know what, I should be an actor because I have so many emotions inside me, right? So I got into Death Wish 4. And then I got kicked off the set of, Trains, Planes, and Automobiles. You don't ever want to steal a mariachi band off a set. Don't do that because it gets you, they don't like that. Anyways, but in the middle of all this insanity, I came up with a great idea. I noticed that they had Screen Actors Guild, they had Screen Extras Guild, they had AFTRA, but they didn't have anything for still frame modeling. And I thought to myself, I'm setting up a modeling union because I love women and I love sex. I did that for you, Bonnie. She asked me earlier, it's her 21st birthday tonight, and she came up to me and said, "Hey, could you do a little something about sex?" I said, "Sure, we'll squeeze it in." So we set up a gig called Associated Visual Talents International, and I went to the Teamsters Union and said, "I'm going to give you a facelift." And I'm not saying this to some cowpoke. I'm saying this to Jackie Presser. And Jackie looks at me and says, "You know what, kid? I like the whole plan. We're going to cut $600,000 to you, and we're going to get this thing started." I looked at him and I said, "You're making a good decision. You are a decision maker. Press hard. Bottom copy's yours, right?" And you know, got that fired up. Now, see, the thing is that when you're 22, 23 years old, and you're drunk, you know, your judgment's really askew, you know? And so anyways, we get everything set up. I call my buddies from Silicon Valley and say, "Come on down, we got plenty of what you're looking for," right? Because I had lots and lots of women signing up and men, you know? Anyways, one of the guys took $400,000 of that $600,000 and wire transferred it into an account in Belize. And I was up in... And I was up on Laurel Canyon. I was on Laurel Canyon. I was waxing out my car, and up pulls a couple of guys, and they said, "Hey, how you doing?" I said, "Good. How you doing?" They said, "Hey, come on in here." They walked me into the little garage, and they stuck a .45 under my chin, and they told me, you know, that the accounts are wrong, and you got 24 hours to square it up. I looked at them and said, "No problem. You're covered." And they left, and as they left, I went down on my belly and joined the Navy, you know, because it's really tough to penetrate the Navy, you know. So you guys haven't ever done anything like this? So anyways, I look at the recruiting officer, and I said, "I'm so American, I can feel it down to the toes of my bone, man. I want in." You know? He goes, What do you want to be?" I said, "Man, I want to be a diver. I want to be a diver." He goes, "You know what? We got a program just for you." He goes, "We're sending you to Orlando, Florida, and I mean tomorrow, because we don't want you changing your mind, right?" And there I went on a bus to an airport, and I mean, I am so twisted drunk. I got one boot on, and he's handing me everybody else's dockets, and "You're the one in charge." And I got one boot on, getting on the airplane, you know, going, "All right, but you're covered," you know. And So all the way to Orlando, Florida, get my head shaved. I'm standing there in Navy dungarees and boots, and I decide, you know, they basically give you one phone call before they send you into basic. So I decide, I'm going to call L.A. back and see how things are going. I call this guy, Mark Kelly. I go, "Mark, what's going on?" He goes, "Everything's cool. They figured everything out. You're in the clear. Wherever you are, come on back." I said, "I got to go." You know? Yeah, I'm signed up, you know. They don't let you out. So, anyways, you know, but, hey, you know, the grace of God, right? I'm sitting in the Navy, and what do? They put you in an 8-week lockdown. They feed you down and dirty food. They make you do push-ups. But what am I doing? I'm detoxing, right? I got 8 weeks of nothing but good food, people kicking me in the back of the head saying, "More push-ups, son!" You know? And that's it. And it was funny, but it did the trick. You know, all of a sudden I'm thinking, "Hey, this ain't bad." And as a matter of fact, they don't treat you so bad. They just yell at you. And I'm used to that. You know? Everybody yells at me. So, anyways, I'm in. And then from there, they said, "A school, you take your pick. You did good and basic. What do you want?" And I said, I want to be a specialist in navigation." They said, "Okay." And I went to A school, and I graduated top 3% of the class in navigation. I was a quartermaster. And just as I did that, a guy with a big, like, badass eagle that's hanging onto a musket and everything's up on his chest, and he walks up to me. He's a full-blown master chief. He looks at me and he goes, "You know what? You got what it takes to be a SEAL." I said, "What's a SEAL?" He laughed his ass off. He goes, "Shit, we're the elite of the elite. We're the baddest guys in all the world." And he goes, "I'll tell you what. If you pass our course of rigorous training, you get an extra stripe, you get hazardous duty pay, you get jump pay, you get dive pay, plus you get your choice between Virginia or San Diego." And bells went off. I said, "I got family in San Diego. Where do I sign?" Right? And there I go. I'm off into the wonderful world of BUDS, Basic Underwater Demolitions. And let me tell you what, they mean it. They want you to get wet. They want you to run with dynamite, C4, C5. Here's your M60. Here's your throwing knives. Get out there and kill. And you know what? I love that. You know why? Because I don't care about anybody but me. Right? And so for me to be loaded up with all the armament that I could ever need, all the backbone training that I would ever need for infiltration or for any kind of tactic that would be useful in my life that's coming, give it to me, you know? So, Anyways, I made it. I went SEALs. I made it. But then, as I was in the teams, they would give you a thing that's called liberty. And what liberty means is that they give you a check and tell you you got a little time to yourself. And I look at those guys and go, "You mean it?" Right? And guess what? I took every liberty possible, you know? I mean, I can remember being in a hotel and I got a guy's teeth stuck in my knuckles and I'm in my dress whites, I'm covered in blood, and I got my handcuffs, you know, and I'm looking at this cop saying, "Thank God you're safe," you know? You know, that's just the way I was. I was never an easygoing drunk, you know. I was extremely violent, you know. That's the way I was raised, violent, right? And to be part of the special forces, I used to love the line, drill instructor would look at you and say, "Son, this is not the normal forces. This is special forces." I love that. I mean, feed my ego, right? Anyways, there was a young man that was killed in training. We were doing a expedition in front of President Reagan and Secretary Webb, Secretary of Defense, out on San Clemente Island, and this kid was killed. And for some reason, right in the middle of that happening, I realized that everything that I was doing was probably against everything I really, really stood for, you know? In the middle of my heart of hearts, and I need to let everybody know, is that I'm just genuinely a child of God, right? All I really wanted to do was play good basketball, good baseball, be a good swimmer, be a good guy, you know, and help people when I could. And all these things are inside you, you know, all of them. But when you're loaded and you're around bikers and everybody else that convinces you that world's tough out there, get tougher, you know, and that's what you're up against, and that's what you're being trained by. Your subconscious takes over and says, "You know what? That's what I need to be because that's what they're telling me I need to be." But when this kid got killed, he was 21 years old, and something happened to me. Something happened to me that shouldn't have happened, but it did happen. And I can remember looking at a guy named Gasner, and I said, "Hey, I'm going to Ensenada. I know it's UA, unauthorized leave of absence, but I'm out of here." And I was there for 2 days, and I'm in the middle of a sunglass stacking contest, and I've done tequila poppers all day long, and I got a leather jacket on that's zipped down to my navel, and I got my trident stuck on the outside in a foreign country. Well, if you've ever been in the military, that's really dumb, right? Don't do that, right? Well, Gasner was a good guy, and he actually told somebody where I went. So they sent somebody down there to collect me. They found me. And the guy looked at me, and you could see him. He's set. He goes, "I'm here to arrest you." And as he's saying, "Here to arrest me," he's reaching for my trident. Well, I grabbed his wrist and snapped it, and then heel palm strike him on top of the nose and went through an enormous fight and left him for dead, basically. Then I swam a little piece of the coast and then jumped up out of the water and hitchhiked in and then got across the border, San Ysidro, and then got to Coronado Island and turned myself in and told them where the guy was. And when you do stuff like this, you get court-martialed. But that's based on the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which you shouldn't fuck with. But in any case, here I am, and instead of them court-martialing me, I can remember this guy looking at me and saying, "You know what, McCracken, we'd like to have you evaluated." And see, I had a neck from my earlobes to my shoulders. I had guns that were probably 22 inches out, and I mean abs that you could shoot and I'd feel good about it, right? And I'm looking at this guy going, "Evaluated? What are you talking about?" He goes, "Well, explain it to them." And I look behind me. I got 7 MPs behind me, and they're going, "Every guy." I said, "Okay." So next thing I know, I'm in Balboa State Hospital or Naval Hospital. I'm standing there with a paper mache robe on with styrofoam smiley slippers. And I mean, there's just no ring of macho there when that's happening, you know. It's all gone. And, you know, alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, let me tell you, your story might not be the same as mine. But there's some asshole out there that's going to top it, you know. You go, you know what? In any case, you'll be able to ring little dots in the middle of your story that say, nope, that was the turning point. Nope, that is where I made probably the most heinous crime in my life. This, no, you'll be able to ding it right down the line and say, nope, that's where it happened. If you go through the 12 steps, you'll never figure none of it out. If you look at people go, going to another meeting, but I ain't doing no steps, you know. Going to another meeting, but not calling my sponsor. Yep, I'm going to call somebody and let them know I care about them because it's spiritual, you know. But never, ever do any looking at yourself. That's a dead killer right there. Anyways, needless to say, I came out of the Navy. Now, I thought that I would come out of the Navy with a dishonorable discharge. But what they gave me was a general discharge under honorable conditions because I did an awful lot of stuff on behalf of the U.S. government that was good. It was just that one dinger right there at the back end that just it didn't add up. And they looked at me and said, hey, you want to stay in or you want out? And as they said out, they said with a $10,000 fine. And I said, I'll take the out, right? And I had $8,000 on me and I left a $2,000 debt, which took me 4 years to pay them, and it was only through AA that I paid it, right? Anyways, so this is in June of 1988. I'm out of the Navy. As I come out of the Navy, I'm unpredictable, right? And, you know, and I've got a lot of great training. and you take all that training and combine it with some really good whiskey and dope, you know, you're just crazy. I won't go in and bore you with the details of how crazy, but I can say that it took me on a two-year run, 2 years of nonstop insanity. And I'll tell you what my last drunk was, then we'll go into the good side, because there's nothing worse than just continual drunk a lot. But my last drunk was a sad drunk, you know, and I need all of you to say, aw. It's terrible. It's terrible. Well, I had negotiated my way into being a recruiter at a sales company, and they paid me on purely commission because that's all I was worth was whatever I could sell. That's what I'd make, you know. And it was around Christmas time, and I got a guy sold into XYZ company, and I had a $3,000 check coming to me. And I remember looking at this guy, John, and he's looking at me, and it's, you know, 4:10 in the afternoon, and he's saying, you know, John, we are really glad you're a part of our operation here because you're doing phenomenally well. And we really, really appreciate all your hard work and efforts. And while he's saying this to me, I'm thinking, give me the check. You know, give me the check. I really, really, really need the check. Right? So as he's done with it, he says, congratulations, your first sale. And he slides that check across the table. I said, thank you very much. Good to see you. Well, Merry Christmas. Bang, out of there, man. And I'm blasting down to Wells Fargo, and I come sliding in, and I look at that teller, and I got a twitch in my eye. I endorse the back of the check, and I look at it, and I go, I'd like to deposit $100, you know, and give me $2,900 back. And I raced down to Penny's Place, which is it was a biker's bar in Los Gatos. Now, see, at the time, I was in a co-signed Ford Tempo that was co-signed by my mother. That's the kind of biker I was, you know. I raced down to Penny's Place in a Tempo and blast in there and say, drinks on Johnny, you know, because you got to have that biker voice when you're in there, you know, because you can't be normal. So I start buying everybody drinks and loading up, and it's maybe 6 o'clock at night, and we do this up until 11. 11 o'clock at night, a guy looks at me and goes, "Hey, Johnny, can you get any booger sugar?" And I look at him and I go, "No sweat, baby. Give me all your money." And he gives me money, and I got my money, and I run up into Santa Cruz, and I blast up there, and I've already drank probably a fifth of whiskey and probably 16 to 20 beers, and I'm driving this car as fast as I can, pitching it into the corners and taking it through the sideways up to the top of this mountain. And I get up to this guy's house, and I look at him, and I go, "I'd like to buy 2 ounces, right?" And he looks at me and goes, "No sweat, Johnny, you're a good customer, right?" And I come in there and I drill all the money across the table. And I look off and there's a big bag of white stuff. I go, "What's that?" He goes, "Inositol." And I said, "Well, throw an ounce on top of one of those and give me the pure one, right?" And I shake it all up and I race back down to Penny's place. And I look at the guy and I wrap it up in a newspaper because that's what you do. And then I flip it to him. And he looks at me and he goes, "You coming in?" I go, "Nah, I'm going home." And it's weird because I'll use yours before mine every time. And for some reason, I look at him and go, "Nah, I'm going home." And I race down to the liquor store and I am really, really shaky, edgy, weird right now. I mean, it's like 12 o'clock at night and I'm nutting up, right? And I've done a ton of dope and drank and everything else. And I walk into this liquor store going like this, and I grab a bottle of Southern Comfort, and see, I hate Southern Comfort because it's a chick's drink, but see, my hand's on the bottle, and once you touch something, you can't put it back because you look like you don't know what you're doing. So I'm standing there going, you know, put that in there, and then I grab a case of Molson Gold and a case of Heineken, and I walk up, and I buy a stack of pornographic material that any man would be proud of. And I look at the guy and I go, "Ring it up," you know? He's going, you know, "Come on, baby, don't draw down on me," you know? And and so, you know, I get all that stuff put together and I get in the car and, you know, I have a thought, you know. I got a lot of dope here and I want to cook some up. So I rush into Safeway and I grab two tinfoil rolls, and I get a gallon of deionized water. I get a package of baking soda, and I get 20 lighters, man. And I'm looking at that guy. I'm like this, man. I'm looking at this guy, right? And he's sitting there going, "Holy shit. Don't draw down on me," right? I get out of there, man, and I'm thinking, all right, I got everything I need, right? And see, most people, when they're in a car, they stay in it for like, you know, an hour drive or a two-hour drive, right? Maybe 3 hours. But see, I was in that car for 36 hours. And that's a long time to be in a tempo. Right? And does this sound alcoholic? So about six hours towards the end, I'm looking in the mirror and my hands are like this. And my central nervous system is dropping down now. It's just shutting down, and I'm having little tweaks of grand mal seizures happening to me. Dead serious. And my tie's sideways, and my white shirt is all tacked with black marks all over it, and my face is oily, just terrible. And I'm looking in the mirror, and I don't want to look, but it's like it's looking back at me. And I think to myself, "Jesus, Johnny, you're just taking up space, pal. You're just sucking other people's air. You don't belong on this planet. Check out. Just get out. You got plenty to do it." And I can remember twisting up a little tinfoil pipe and then slamming a gram on top of it. No screens, no nothing, and burn it down and trying to seize my heart, you know? Didn't work. Anyways, Alcoholics Anonymous is an amazing organization, right? So I make an attempt on my life. It doesn't work. It's now December 27th, and I call Cocaine Anonymous because I don't want to be alcoholic. And I call this guy, And I go, you know, and the guy goes, dude, I cannot understand you. Do you drink? And I scream into that phone, everybody drinks. Right? The guy goes, hey, you know, this guy's really working his 12 steps on me, you know. He goes, I'll tell you what. There's a little group called Saturday Night Live. They're having a meeting at 12 o'clock today, and I'm going to be there, and you need to rush down there and meet me. My name's Tom. I said, okay, man, I'll be there, you know, because that's, you know. So he gave me a little address and stuff, and I show up over there. Tom's not there, but I am, and I'm in a suit with green slime running down my chewing Chiclets to make sure nobody can tell. Right? This guy came in the same way, so stop laughing. So, anyways, you know, God bless all you guys, because there are so many people that came in and just saved my life right there on the spot and hugged up on me and said, hey, man, sit down. You okay? You want a cup of coffee? Oh, I'd love one. You know? And, you know? I was 4 days dry. 4 days dry, and it was the day I was going to drink. And my sponsor was at the podium. And I didn't know he was my sponsor at the time because I didn't like him because I didn't know him, right? And he's standing at the podium, and he says, I haven't had handcuffs on these All-American wrists in over 20 years. And he's, as he said that, I was having flashbacks, because you can do that when you're new. And I'm picturing the cops beating me over the head and stun gunning me and trying to get my hands behind my back and me locking down going, come on, you know. Normal drinker, right? And, you know. Anyways, this guy's passing a message that I can relate to. No handcuffs for 20 years. He's lying, right? So, anyways, at the end of the meeting, I rush up to this guy and I grab him and I go, I'm going to drink. He goes, let go of me. And I let go of him. And he goes, me too. I said, you are? He goes, yep, I'm going to coffee. And if you want to go to coffee, we can drink that together. And I said, all right. He goes, that's my Cadillac over there. He goes, I don't know what you're in or what you're on, but give me 10 car lengths behind it and follow it. And that was that, you know? And so there I am. I'm following Jim Bayard, right? Dear God, right? But check this out. You want to talk about miraculous? I haven't had a drink since December 28th, 1990. See, that's a long time in between cocktails. And what happened in that little coffee shop is exactly the reason why I'm still here tonight, right? And this trucker, that's all he is, right? Trucker. Big old fat trucker, right? He's just tough, right? And he's looking at me and he goes, are you alcoholic? And man, I looked at him, and for the first time in my life, I was free. I said, yep. And he goes, first step's done. You admitted it. And then he said, do you believe in God? I said, I fucking hate God. And he said, second step's done, baby. And he said, you willing to turn your life and your will over the care of God as you understand him? I said, hey. Let's back up here. I just told you I hate God. And he goes, yeah, let's go over your past, all right? You mind? He goes, you're basically homeless, right? I said, yeah. Living in your car? Yep. He goes, how much money you owe? I said, $80,000. He said, you got any legal problems? I said, two warrants and they're beefs that I can beat. Right? Then he looks at me and he goes, family life going okay for you? And I started bawling. I love my family. I love my family. And I can't have none of them because alcoholism has raped me of all of it. Right? And he looks at me and he goes, hey kid, you might want to try something a tad different. Why don't you try a spiritual program that will relieve you of your alcoholism? You want to try that? I'll walk you through it. I know how to do it. I've been doing it for 20 years. And you know what's so cool about Jim Bayard? Is that he loved me right through all of my character defects, all of my abrasiveness, all of my ego, all of it, and just kept showing me how to be soft enough to walk through and pick up another day. Right? And that's all he's about, by the way. You ever ride in his car with him, he's either listening to an AA tape, taking an AA call, or figuring out how to knock down another newcomer. That's what he does. My life today is amazing. Amazing. I own my own business. I can't tell you the names of the companies that I represent, but they're the very largest in the world. There are no bigger. The heads of those corporations turn to me and ask me for very, very specific marketing strategies that tie to the direct performance of their companies. That's amazing, isn't it? Behind that, I have a son. His name is Patrick James. And I love him. And I pray he'll never see Daddy drunk. I pray that every day. Don't let him catch me drunk, God. And I always tell God, cover me, I'm going in. Right? Because you never know what's going to happen out there. You guys ever seen a drunk man die? Attend his funeral? Man, is that lonely. Usually about 6 or 7 people standing around going, gonna miss him. Let's go. Right? You ever seen a sober alcoholic die? They pack the churches. The bishops show up. I mean, I've been to some incredible funerals that are tied to alcoholics that have given of themselves freely. You ever seen anybody in AA, really in AA, somebody that's truly a part of AA, look at you and say, all right, I'm going to take you through the 12 steps, but it's going to be $150 an hour. You good with that? Let's get started, right? You know what I love about AA? You know? The real miraculous part of AA is this. Is that two guys got together. One guy's name is Bill Wilson. And don't let anybody tell you that this guy was a schlock. Bill Wilson was the very, very best in his field. He was an analyst for financial strategies that were tied to the stock market. And he was one of the best. But he was a drunk. And then there was a shaky-handed proctologist by the name of Dr. Bob. And I'll tell you what, I wouldn't want anybody working on my ass, you know. But a couple of beers, I hear he's pretty good, you know. But these two guys get together out of sheer desperation tied to the disease of alcoholism. And what is today? Today is the 27th of May, 2000. And all of us are packed into this room laughing, enjoying the spirit of the fellowship because of those two guys that decided to come together and do something about this problem called alcoholism, this disease called alcoholism. I'd like to read the last two paragraphs of my favorite page in the book. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, first 164 pages cover a design for living that will allow you to understand your disease. The rest of the book will give you plenty of stories to relate to and find your personality or your area of where you had your little click of insanity. It'll be there in the back of the book somewhere for you. But the first 164 pages allow you to understand the disease of alcoholism and how to live sober one day at a time. Anyways, this is on page 164. It's the last two paragraphs. It's for the newcomer, the in-betweener, and the old-timer. And it goes like this. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answer will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you for passing it on and letting me be a part of this. Thanks.